The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I think we should be more worried than we are in that the way in which our technology works is a little different. The printing press remained a distributed network. Gutenberg didn't control all the printing presses in Germany. There was actually no central control, really. Our network has become highly centralized because the network platforms have this winner-takes-all quality, so that one monopoly after another emerges. Amazon in online retail, Google in online search, Facebook in online networks. Nothing like that happened in the age of the printing press. And these particular network platforms are engines of polarization. They are set up to accentuate the existing divisions in our society.
I'm Matthew Kahn, and you're listening to the Lawfare Podcast, March 27th, 2018. Social networks increasingly dominate public and private life. Neil Ferguson argues in his new book, The Square and the Tower, Networks, Hierarchies, and the Struggle for Power, that in our society, the computer plays the revolutionary role that the printing press played 500 years ago, and that throughout history, the powerful role of networks has often been overlooked. At the Hoover Institution earlier this month, Ferguson spoke to Jack Goldsmith about why historians have glossed over networks, the rightful place of networks in the study of history, and what the modern dominance of social networks means for the future of power. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 295, Neil Ferguson on the Square and the Tower.
So, Neil, the book opens with an overview of network theory, and then it's an extraordinarily ambitious book. It aims to basically review history, the history of mankind, through this lens of the distinction and the ebb and flow of hierarchies and networks. So is that a good description? And tell us about the book.
The Square and the Tower is an attempt to think differently about history. It's mostly the last 500 years, but there are some excursions into ancient history. And I start with a false dichotomy. It's not many books start with a false dichotomy, but I do quite deliberately, and that is a dichotomy between networks and hierarchies. Most people, I think, intuitively have that false dichotomy in their heads. When I say the square and the tower, meaning the square is where you socialize, where social networks happen, and the tower is where power resides, hierarchically organized, that makes sense, I think, to most people. And most of you in your daily lives will move between the square of your social network, your friends, your family, and there's some org chart in most of our lives. I mean, even the Hoover Institution has an org chart, though it is honored mainly in the breach. So we understand that there are these different modes of operation. And the book starts there and says, well, let's think of history as, in some sense, the interplay of social networks and political hierarchies. And then what I try to show using network science as the guide is that is actually a false dichotomy, and that human organizations can be both networks and hierarchies on a continuum, And the sweet spot is probably an organization that captures enough hierarchical structure to be viable, to be capable of strategic decision making, but enough network architecture to be responsive and creative. I think it's fair to say that the creative impulse in human organizations tends to come from the network side of the organizational spectrum. The problem about trying to organize the world mainly on the basis of distributed or decentralized networks is that they're very bad at defense. They're very bad at security. As I like to put it, if you think two-factor authentication is going to make your network secure, I've got a bridge to sell you. So the reason that hierarchical structures tend to dominate the historical narrative is that for most of history, human beings have prioritized security and defense. There are no armies run like Facebook groups. There's a reason why command structures are so vital to the operation of the military, of any military enterprise. So I think that's a helpful, if somewhat false, dichotomy, the distinction between the square and the tower. It's intuitive, but the book is supposed to show you that, in fact, there's a continuum, and we're really talking here about a distinction between hierarchical networks and distributed networks, hierarchically organized or vertically organized forms of network organization, and those that are genuinely decentralized, where there really isn't any commanding central node.
And speaking of vertical organization, it's not just armies, it's the state is the ultimate, or one of the ultimate vertical organizations, and it's largely, at least, or partly in the business of defense. So before we get to some examples, the book suggests that historians have not exclusively, but largely, seen history through the lens of hierarchies. Not exclusively, but largely. So tell us about why historians have done that and why this type of history is different.
It's a professional deformation that historians tend to go to archives, and archives tend to be produced by hierarchically structured organizations. The state keeps archives for a practical reason. Knowledge is power. It also helps to know what your predecessors did. And so archives arise mainly because vertically structured structures of governance need them. Big corporations also tend to have archive departments. And historians, there are some working historians in the room, will know the magnetic power of a well-ordered archive. But if you base most of your research in those archives, you will see the world from a hierarchical perspective. You will see the world the way the bureaucracy saw it. For me, it was a kind of moment of enlightenment early in my career. I was trying to write the history of the German hyperinflation of the early 1920s. That was my doctoral dissertation topic. And I was sitting in the Hamburg State Archives looking through the bureaucracy's documents. And the hyperinflation was not there, because the bureaucracy of the Hamburg State in the early 1920s just carried on as if everything was normal. The only clue was when any price appeared in the documents, and then the number of zeros told you that something somewhat strange was happening. And this was really frustrating. I was scared. I had a doctoral dissertation to write, and there was no material in the central archive of the Hamburg State. Then one day I did a little social networking. I was having tea at the British consulate, and I met a delightful elderly gentleman who listened to my lament and said, "Oh, well, you better come and look at my father's papers." And this was Eric Warburg, son of Max Warburg, who had been in his heyday the most influential financier in the city of Hamburg. I went the next day to the Ferdinandstrasse. I was shown into his father's old study where all his father's files were still kept. And there it was. The story of the hyperinflation was, in fact, in the papers of the network of bankers who had watched this catastrophe unfold. It wasn't in the hierarchical archive at all. And the insight I take from that today is that the history of networks is just harder to write because the stuff, like the networks, is distributed. There's not a central archive of the German Jewish financial elite. That doesn't exist. And yet the German Jewish financial elite was hugely important in the 19th and 20th centuries. If you want to write that history, you have to go one bank at a time, one family at a time, and laboriously assemble it. So it's harder. And I think that's why social networks have played too small a role in mainstream historical narratives. It's just difficult to do.
That's great. So you tell your story, and as you say, you focus on the last 500 years. You talk about the Roman Empire and the spread of Christianity and Islam. Let's talk about where networks combined with technological innovation had an enormous impact in bringing down or flattening a hierarchy, and that was the Gutenberg Press and Luther. That's an important episode in the book because you think that's an important comparison point for modern times.
The central analogy of the book, Jack, is the Reformation compared with our own time. 501 years ago, Martin Luther launches a campaign to reform the Roman Catholic Church. And you probably read in your high school textbook that he nailed his thesis to the door of a church. If that had been the only communications technology available to Martin Luther, we would never have heard of him. He would have been taken out like the heretics of previous generations who hadn't really got past first base. The difference is that in 1517, there's already a large network of printing presses all across Germany, and Luther's message goes viral. It's printed in multiple locations. His sermons and theses are published in extraordinary volumes. I mean, Luther dominates the content that is being produced by printing presses in the early 1520s, and that's why the Reformation is possible. It was, I think, it would not have succeeded had it been done with the written word. There's a great couple of papers by a guy named Dittmar, whom I cite in the book, who explicitly compares the impact of printing with the impact of the personal computer and the internet. And it's very striking that the price of communication follows a similar spectacular 99% decline, and the volume of information follows the same exponential growth. The only real difference is that everything happens 10 times faster in our time. But it's the same identical process. For me, the most striking insight is that, like many of the architects of the internet, Luther was an optimist who believed that if everybody could have access to scripture through printing, translation of the Bible into the vernacular, everybody could have a more direct relationship with God, not necessarily mediated by a corrupt clergy, and everything would be awesome. He didn't use exactly those words, but that was the basic idea. He thought the priesthood of all believers, which the Bible talks about, might actually be achieved. What happened? Instead of that, there was the drastic polarization of Reformation and Counter-Reformation. About half of Europe said, "We agree with you, Martin, but you don't go far enough." And the other half said, "You're a heretic. Let's burn these people." And Europe had about 130 years of conflict, some of it extraordinarily violent, on the issues that Luther had raised. In our time, the analogy, I think, works quite well. Going back to the 1990s and John Perry Barlow's Declaration of the Independence of Cyberspace, Silicon Valley has told us, when everybody is connected, everything will be awesome. And they did say that. They did say that everything would be awesome. And I've heard this ad nauseum. You still hear it when you go and live in Northern California. A planet where everything is connected will be amazing. We'll solve the world's problems. That was the message of Facebook until quite recently. Mark Zuckerberg was going to build a global community. The analogy with the Reformation is that that was about as likely as Luther's priesthood of all believers. In just the same way as happened in the 16th century, what the internet has done, and this is especially true with the advent of the network platforms like Google and Facebook, is to create an engine for polarization. Wherever you look now, whether it's on Facebook or on Twitter, clusters of broadly liberal and conservative thinking have formed. And these clusters are becoming further apart and less in touch with one another. So I think we have a kind of secular equivalent of the Reformation in our time. And that, I think, is the most powerful analogy that the book has to offer.
It's a brilliant analogy. But in the end of chapter 9, you say that when set in its proper context, the present time, I think you're referring to the age of the internet, and I think the context is the Reformation, the present time appears less unnervingly unprecedented and more familiar. So I agree with that, and we'll talk about that, but I have to say that you reminded me how extraordinarily violent and destructive the Reformation was for 120 years, and do you think we are at the beginnings of something that's potentially equally as destructive?
I think we should be more worried than we are.
Yeah.
In that the way in which our technology works is a little different. The printing press remained a distributed network. Gutenberg didn't control all the printing presses in Germany. There was actually no central control, really. Our network has become highly centralized because the network platforms have this winner-takes-all quality so that one monopoly after another emerges. Amazon in online retail, Google in online search, Facebook in online networks. Nothing like that happened in the age of the printing press. And these particular network platforms are engines of polarization. They are set up to accentuate the existing divisions in our society. How come? Well, because they essentially direct information content to you on the basis of what you have previously engaged with, as most of you will be aware, there is a filter bubble or echo chamber effect. It's like confirmation bias institutionalized. You will only hear more of what you already engaged with. That's inherent in the business model, by the way.
As is, let me just add an emphasis for the extreme views to tend to
extreme views as much as fake news proliferate in this setting. And one thing that's extremely interesting is the way in which that tendency for extreme views to proliferate works. There are a couple of ways it works. On Twitter, there's a nice paper that came out after the book that shows this. A tweet is on a political subject. A tweet on a political subject is 20% more likely to be retweeted for every one emotive or moral word that it uses. That's academic euphemism for strong language. That's why left-wing tweets always have the F word in them. Because the more strongly you express your view, the more likely it is to be retweeted. We also have the strange phenomenon of Google and YouTube search, which if you search for a topic, will not just give you more of the same as suggestions for where to go next, it will give you more extreme content on the same subject. So we've created engines that drive people out across the political spectrum, either to the left or the right. Last point, the lesson of the 16th and 17th century is that verbal violence is often the prelude to actual violence. We're at the verbal violence stage mostly right now, but I don't see anything in history to say we can't go further down the path towards actual violence, nor do I see anything in history to say that the process of polarization reaches some equilibrium point. If anything, I would say 19th century American history is a dire warning that what begins in the realm of language ends on the battlefield. So what worries me a little is that there is a sense in which this process of polarization can keep going. There's nothing to stop it. Nothing has changed in the way that the major network platforms operate. And I do worry that our politics has a record, American politics has a record, of going from the verbal to the actual violence. So yeah, I think we need to be more worried. And I think the reason I wrote the book and focused on the 16th and 17th century is that the scenario where arguments about transubstantiation and consubstantiation lead to massacres, that scenario should warn us that what can seem like an arcane dispute about hate speech, a favorite word of our time, is in practice a debate about heresy. The term hate speech is a substitute for heresy. And when one is accused, and I've been accused of this, of hate speech, you are being accused of heresy. And the secular reformation that I see going on in America today, and it's very visible on American campuses, troubles me. Because once people use this terminology, they have taken an important step away from civil discourse, away from what we are doing now, in the direction of something more like the duel.
I couldn't agree more. It's a depressing insight, but I think it's absolutely right. The next question, I guess, is how should we think about what to do about it? How should the state, the hierarchical organization, think about addressing this problem? It's, as you talk about in the book, it's not just political polarization and the weaponization of speech. It's also that these platforms allow fake news, as you say. They facilitate cross-border information operations. They exacerbate economic inequality. There's a fundamental critique of these platforms in the book, which is outstanding. So those are a lot of different problems. Taking the most important of those, how should we think about what to do about this? This goes a little beyond the book, but you give hints in the book.
The book does not have a whole bunch of policy prescriptions at the end, and that will probably cause some of the Washington crowd to want to leave immediately.
But here we are. I know you have views.
This morning, why don't you come up with something that's ready to be legislated? The book deliberately doesn't go there, but there is clearly an implication about the need for something to be done.
And if I could just say one more thing before you answer. There's also, I don't think you're quite overt, but I think one of the implications is we need to think more about hierarchies. Is that fair?
Right. So there's a critique that goes beyond what we've said so far. You touched on it briefly there, but it includes the problem that blatant untruths seem more likely to go viral than true statements. That's a major problem. In the Reformation, by the way, the theory that witches were amongst us went viral in the places that most enthusiastically embraced the Reformation, like my own country, Scotland, which burnt a great many witches. So crazy stuff going viral is another thing that history would lead you to expect, as also network science leads you to expect. You mentioned the inequality problem. Network economics, tremendously inegalitarian.
Right.
They magnify existing inequalities and make them a great deal.
And that's a large difference with the Reformation.
Which is a big difference. And that's because of the ownership. As I mentioned earlier, nobody really owned the printing press. There was no... Gutenberg actually went bankrupt at one point and ended his life on a state pension. There were no billionaires produced by the printing press. Our network is owned by a tremendous, a small elite of very wealthy, mostly men. This creates, I think, a fundamentally unstable, unsustainable state of affairs. 80% of news consumed in the United States today, 80, is referred to the user by either Google or Facebook. That is how most news is now consumed, via those platforms. 45% of Americans get their news from Facebook. That means that Facebook's newsfeed algorithm is the most powerful editor on the planet, second only to the Google search ranking. It seems to me that the public sphere has been transformed in a way that we are still struggling to comprehend, but the net effect has been to create, in someone like Mark Zuckerberg, a figure more powerful than William Randolph Hearst at the height of his power. What do we do? Facebook says, leave it to us, we will fix Facebook. Self-regulation is all you need. The left says, these are monopolies, and we need antitrust actions to break them up. And the right says, duh. I see no serious engagement with this problem on the right. Which is amazing, because the companies I'm talking about skew so far left that they are essentially the campus translated into the realm of business. The politics of the campus, I hear this again and again from people in Silicon Valley, the politics of social justice, the politics of trigger warnings, of microaggressions, has migrated into the big technology companies, which is why James Damore was sacked from Google. So these companies that now dominate the public sphere and determine what news Americans see are almost entirely to the left of center. And not just a little bit to the left of center, quite a lot to the left of center. And conservatives are like, oh, we don't do regulation, we're conservatives. Don't say that word. I used the regulation word at the American Enterprise Institute World Forum at the weekend. honestly, was like taking out a clove of garlic at a convention of vampires. But what the hell else are we going to do? I mean, you can do it a couple ways, and I think this is something we should try and talk about, Jay, and I'd love to get your thoughts on this, because in some ways this is above my pay grade. Either you say to yourself, they're utilities, and our First Amendment rights are potentially threatened by them, in which case they need to be regulated in such a way as to maintain our First Amendment rights, so that, for example, Dennis Prager's Prager University is not systematically discriminated against by the Google search algorithm, which it is. Because Google now has a lot of Prager University content marked as restricted, which means that anybody using the internet at a college or a high school may not be able to see it, won't come up in the search results, because the restriction will prevent that. So there's that. And there's a case, I gather, underway about that specific issue right now in the California courts. Or, and this is the more wonkish piece, do we look again at the exemption introduced in 1996 in what was then the Communications and Decency Act, Title 230 of which says, if you're a technology company, you have no liability for the content that appears on your platform. None. For me, this is just the anomaly of anomalies. It creates a completely non-level playing field in which content publishers are defined as such are liable for the content and any harm that arises from it. And the technology platforms who take that content are home free with almost no liability. My instinct, and you can correct me if I'm wrong about this, is that conservatives should not want to add to the power of a regulatory state, but they should want this to be settled in the courts. I don't like to give you lawyers more work, but it does seem to me that a world of litigation might change the ways in which Google and Facebook behave. Currently, they really don't have that much to fear from litigation. It's hard to get standing even to sue them. So my sense is that we as conservatives need to have a better answer to the question than we currently have. The left has its answer. It's a time-honored answer, antitrust. It's not going to work, since the courts at the time of Bork said the test is consumer benefit.
Right.
You don't have a chance taking Jeff Bezos to court on antitrust. That's going to be the shortest case in American legal history. So the antitrust idea is a non-starter, in my view. It won't get past first base in the courts. So I think we who think about these issues need to come up with something better. So, the status quo is indefensible. Let me add a political point. If we do nothing, the midterms are going to be worse than you already think, a lot worse, because never again will the network platforms in Silicon Valley allow conservative candidates to use them as Donald Trump's campaign used them in 2016. The sound of heads exploding on November the 9th, 2016 was deafening in Northern California. They couldn't believe that Facebook advertising had been so vital to Trump's success, which it was. I don't think he would have become president without Facebook. As people think more and more about this, they will, I think, begin to grasp the power of the platforms. I think the Russia issue is a distraction from the real question, which is the power in our politics of Facebook, YouTube, and the rest. So we've got to come up with a better answer than self-regulation, because self-regulation, I think, means disaster for conservatives. Yes. Conservatives are simply going to be at a disadvantage. The algorithm is already in some ways skewed against far-right elements, for sure, but who decides? Who decides who is alt-right and doesn't belong in the public sphere? After Charlottesville, there were some pretty open admissions that Silicon Valley chief executives decide, and if they don't like the cut of your jib, goodbye, you'll be on page 10 of the search.
And as you say, so I don't have some responses, but I don't have any answers. The essential problem here is that this is speech, and the government has a very difficult time regulating speech, even in an economic context, and that's the first problem. I agree with you that antitrust is not a fruitful way to go. I don't think the public utility analogy works for a variety of reasons. They don't naturally fit into that. I'm not so sure. It's definitely the 230 exemption is under pressure. I think it's going to be under pressure first on things like child pornography and sort of things
like trafficking,
sex trafficking, and things like that. But I'm less confident than you that what are the harms that are going to be litigated if the 230 exemption narrows. The essential problem for conservatives, I think, is that if you're going to rely on the government to protect your speech, you're not going to be. So I'm not, Congress is pressuring the social media firms, the platforms are now acting to try to clean up their act after the 2016 election. They're doing so because Congress pretty clearly in the hearings in December and January threatened them with regulation, even though Congress probably can't regulate. It lacks the constitutional power, among other things. So they are taking steps to clean up their own internal act where they can control the speech platform according to their rules of terms of service. But I agree it's not going in a direction that's going to be good for conservatives.
Well, in fact, it's going the very worst direction.
In the worst direction,
because what happens is that our community standards is a very flexible concept. You are not complying with our community standards, therefore out you go, or you get restricted. You know, the question of who decides on those community standards is much more important than we realize today. And it's kind of a black box. But if you drill down into what they've been doing since they said they were cleaning up their act, it includes consulting the Southern Poverty Law Center.
Right.
You know, can you believe that those shysters are still in business? That the New Yorker is publishing articles praising their heroic work against the far right? It blows my mind. And it makes me furious. Because another Hoover fellow, my wife, Ayan Hirsi Ali, is on the wrong side of this. The Southern Poverty Law Center has a list of, quote, anti-Muslim extremists. Doesn't have a list of Muslim extremists, by the way, the people who actually kill people. But it has a list of anti-Muslim extremists, and she's on it. So Google, or whoever it is, says, gee, we need to make sure that there's no hate speech on the platform. The Germans are giving us grief, and who knows, it may become a problem here. Better find out who the extremists are. Well, I just did computer science. I don't know. Who do you think we should call up? Let's Google it. Southern Poverty Law Center, call those guys. You see how this works? And pretty quickly, we have a very dangerous feedback loop in which Silicon Valley says, please tell us who's in violation of our community standards, consults the Southern Poverty Law Center, and bingo. People are being lumped in with the alt-right, the white supremacists, indiscriminately, because that's what the left does.
So it's one possibility. I don't have any great solution, and I agree it's a serious problem. But on the other hand, as you point out in your book, and as you said a second ago, Donald Trump was enormously successful in using Facebook and Twitter to help him win the presidency. And as you talk about in your book, populism more generally has, at least in part, been driven by robust social media. That suggests that conservatives can use these tools to their ends. And I'm wondering whether there's a self-correcting mechanism if these platforms become too overtly anti-conservative? Are these networks too entrenched for competitors to rise up? Or is there any kind of economic pressure that the conservative consumer users of these technologies can bring to bear?
It's very difficult because the network economics have a winner-takes-all character. And it's pretty tough to imagine a rival to Facebook getting anywhere. The network effects are very powerful. Metcalfe's law says the bigger the network is, the more valuable it is. And Facebook has more than 2 billion users now. You know, good luck with Hoover Facebook if we decide to set that up. It's not going to be easy to get to 2 billion. So I think there is a self-correction at work already, and it is the self-correction Silicon Valley is doing to make sure 2016 never happens again. So 2016 was a nightmare for them. I've heard it explicitly said, we're tweaking the algorithm so that never happens again. You can tweak the algorithm, I've also heard it said, so that Sean Hannity disappears from the newsfeed, even of conservative users. This is a mighty power that they wield. A number of former Facebook people have been speaking out on this issue, and I think often very intelligently. One interesting recommendation is that the algorithm should be visible. We should know what it is. It should not be secret. Another is, of course, the issue of data portability, which the Europeans are pursuing this year. And by the way, while we
sit on our hands, the Europeans are going to regulate these companies.
And they're in the midst. They've been doing so for a while, and they're getting... Yeah. There was another report today that the French had, can't remember if it was an indictment or a civil suit, but for abusive commercial practices against three or four American internet firms. And they're not shy about regulation. But it's not clear that that form of regulation is going to be helpful to the problem we've identified.
No, I don't think it is, because unfortunately what happens, as I alluded to earlier, is that the Germans have a broad definition of hate speech. Their policy is to fine the Silicon Valley companies aggressively if they don't police the internet on behalf of the German
government. And in fact, that regulation, is a good chance it's going to have extraterritorial impact on Google, and that will definitely cut out a lot more conservative speech.
So I find the direction of travel in Europe broadly wrong. Data portability is the exception, but essentially the British government is in danger of doing this too, essentially asking the network platforms, please could you censor the internet on our behalf and we'll fine you if you let any hate speech through? I mean, the incentive that are being created by that kind of legislation are horrible, in my view.
So going back a moment to the John Perry Barlow era, at the dawn of the internet, and you talk in your book about how Bill Clinton said that regulating the internet was like nailing Jell-O to the wall. He was in China when he said that, and the belief in the 1990s was that the network was going to take down authoritarian states. And there were times when things seemed precarious, and during the Arab Spring, at first it seemed like Twitter and Facebook were very consequential in promoting those revolutionary movements. From my perspective, it seems like in March of 2018 that movement is failing and that authoritarian states are figuring out, you talk about China especially, are figuring out how to reverse engineer the technology to enhance their surveillance. China is insisting in a way the United States never will on access to back doors for encrypted information. China is, as you talk about, coming up with social scores for individuals. They're eliminating anonymity. They're going to have potentially perfect surveillance. Perfect is too strong. Extraordinary, unprecedented surveillance and control because of the network. And they've turned the network into a tool of control. Mm-hmm. I see that hierarchy winning that battle. At least I see that's the direction it's going. And I see open society hierarchies losing that battle precisely because we have free speech, we have a non-regulatory tradition. I see our strengths hurting us in response to the combination of the network and the new technologies. What do you think?
I think what's happening in China is extraordinary and alarming to anyone who believes in individual freedom. Jack Ma of Alibaba fame said last October, I think, at a Communist Party conference, that big data was the future of law and order in China. In future, he said, the bad guys won't even get to the square. And I thought, the square, that's great. He's even talking about the square. But what does the square mean in China? There's only one square that anybody ever really is referring to. The alignment between big tech and the Communist Party is now perfect. Jack Ma is the junior partner of Xi Jinping, who is now emperor for life. No totalitarian regime in the 20th century could even dream of the knowledge that the Chinese government now has of its citizens. Chinese state spends more on domestic policing than on defense, and that's after substantial increases in its defense budget. Police are equipped in some cities with Google Glass type technology that allows them to do facial recognition searches on people they see in railway stations. This is an astonishing level of social control without precedent in history. And it means that the one-party state has a new lease of life. Under these circumstances, dissent is almost impossible. The state can probably anticipate it before you even do it. As Jack Ma says, the bad guy gets picked up before he gets to the square. So I think we need to think very hard about this. It's less than 10 years since the idea that the internet was going to help democracy and topple tyrants, and that whole idea is lying in the dust, I think, at this moment. Do I have an answer? Well, there's no obvious answer to the Chinese problem, but we need to recognize that a new variant of the Cold War is emerging. Yep.
And the network platforms in Silicon Valley only have rivals in China. There are no European rivals. There are no rivals anywhere else. It's Baidu, Alibaba, Tencent versus Fang. So Bat versus Fang, as I say towards
the end. Say what Fang is.
So I wouldn't dream of uttering an acronym without explaining it.
Okay.
Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, Google, and you should probably add Apple, so Faang. The big American tech companies have no rivals other than the Chinese tech companies. I thought until recently that the Chinese tech companies would own China and the Great Firewall would keep out the American companies and the American companies would take the rest of the world. Wrong. I think in the race for the rest of the world, the Chinese tech companies have a pretty good chance of winning because they already have superior payment platforms, superior e-commerce structures, which you can roll out in emerging markets far more readily than the American counterparts can. So watch this space. In the race for global dominance, I think Bat is going to give Fang a pretty good run for its money, which means all of this has a strategic dimension ultimately. And again, I don't think people are giving that enough
thought. I don't think there's any thought given to that. Let's stop there. Thank you so much, Neil.
That's Thank great. You, Jack.
Really appreciate it. That's really great.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Hoover for hosting Jack and Neil. If you haven't yet, please take a few minutes and tell your social network about the Lawfare Podcast and give us a rating and review wherever you listen to us. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. Until next time, thanks for listening.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.